As we know, and from the intimation in the little leaflet, it's the book of Ruth, and the subject is conversion and return from Ruth chapter 1, taken by our brother David Gilliland.
Now we read the passage as announced, chapter 1 of the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1 verse 1, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem Judah. They came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab, the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelled there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah. And Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you, as ye have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you that ye may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept, and they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters, why will ye go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have an husband. If I should say, I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight, and should also bear sons, would ye tarry for them till they were grown? Would ye stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord is gone out against me. And they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And she said, Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. And Ruth said, Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. So they two went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them. And they said, Is this Naomi? And she said unto them, Call me not Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me home again empty. Why then call ye me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. Now we trust the Lord's blessing upon the reading of Holy Scripture. Now, it's obviously part of my responsibility to say some words about chapter 1, but the brethren have also requested that in addition I would make quite a number of remarks about the book in general, just to give us some flavour of the atmosphere of this book and to try and get our minds into gear for the consideration of its 85 verses. The first matter that I think I should mention, well known concerning this book of Ruth, is the fame which the book has enjoyed. You know, children love it. In children's work, they're always glad to hear the story of Ruth. Gospel preachers use it. Our brethren use it very frequently in their ministry. It's a book that has inspired the poetic skill of those who write in poetry. It's a book that has engaged great comment from Jewish rabbis and even critics of the Bible, men who have no sympathy with scriptural subjects. They have been compelled to confess the charm which is inherent in this little book of the Bible. They regard it as a gem of literature, and I think we will see that as we make our way through it. And of course, we not only view the book as a piece of literature, it's an inspired document, and in these Bible readings, we will be concerned to see if we can understand some of the spiritual things that are to be found latent in its pages. So the theme of the book of Ruth is well known. For its size, it has become internationally famous and has held a fascination for many minds, for many centuries, and for many readers. The second thing that I think I should mention would be the facts of the book. Just to rehearse the facts very simply, and to remind ourselves that it is a book, not just a piece of folklore, not just an ancient fable, but it's anchored in history. It actually happened. And it's a farming family. A farming family in the land of Israel. They come upon hard times because of a famine that touches their area. They decide that they should emigrate. And so they pull up the stakes, this man, his wife, and the two boys. They travel from the hills of Bethlehem down into the Jordan Valley, cross the Jordan River. They round the north part of the Dead Sea and go to the land of Moab, which lies upon the eastern shores of the Dead Sea. Not a great distance away. Maybe 50 miles as the crow flies. Maybe a little bit further in the route that they took. So they emigrate and they relocate in a foreign land to escape the hardships of famine. While they are there, the two boys get married to two girls from Moab. Also in their time there, tragedy strikes again. The husband dies. And tragedy strikes another blow. In the course of time, the two boys die. And what was a group of six, with three males and three females, is quickly reduced to three. And the three males are gone. And three solitary grieving widows are left in the land of Moab. An older widow, Naomi, her two daughters-in-law, they are younger widows. Eventually, the older widow decides to head back for home. And the two girls initially come with her, and one of them drops out. And when we get to the end of chapter 1, we have two lonely widows, and they're coming back to Bethlehem. They're in a state of total destitution. They have lost everything. They have lost the harvest. The land that her late husband farmed is now being used by someone else. She cannot touch the harvest that should have been Elimelech's. The holding that once he maintained, he had let it go. She has lost a harvest. She has lost a husband. And she's too old to have another husband, by her own confession. She's beyond childbearing age, and she now has no hope of ever having an heir. The two boys that still remained after her husband died, they were the hope for the future. Old Elimelech is gone, but if the two boys have children, at least the family name will be carried on. But the two boys have also died out of childless marriages. And here's this beleaguered widow. No harvest. No husband, no heir. And when we come to the end of our chapter, or almost the end, it's a situation of total poverty. You feel your heart going out to her in the destitution of her condition. As we come into chapter 2, we're introduced to another member of the family that we hadn't heard of before. He is actually a very wealthy man, a stately man, a landowner. He's a man of considerable resources and a man of great character. He, in some way or another, is a relation of her late husband. His name is Boaz. He provides an answer to every problem which she had. And the remaining chapters of the book of Ruth are Boaz's solutions to Naomi's sorrows. In chapter 2, he gives her a harvest. When the younger widow comes home from his fields, every night she's carrying such a quantity of grain that the old lady can hardly believe her eyes. Where did you get this grain? Where did this come from? And Boaz gives her a harvest. When you get to chapter 3, he promises that he'd become the husband. So in chapter 3, he meets the second problem. And when you get to chapter 4, there's a little boy has been born out of the marriage. The family is not going to be extinguished. And the same man that provided a harvest, and the same man that provided himself as a husband, from that marriage he produced an heir in chapter 4. And Boaz has given the three solutions to the threefold sorrow of this desolate widow. And the book then will end with a genealogy, because it so happens that this boy, this child that is born, is not only born into a royal line, but born into a messianic line. And this child becomes very, very significant in the outworking of God's plan of redemption. It's a very precious reading, this book. It's most refreshing to come from the battlefields of the book of Judges into the barley fields of the book of Ruth, and all the chaos and the corruption and the confusion that spills across the pages of the book of Judges. We leave that behind for the peace and the purity and the piety which pervade these lovely chapters. It's the busy hum of a harvest field. It's the happy joys of family life. And there is a beauty about the book of Ruth. It's domestic simplicity. It's rustic joy. I think we will find it to be very, very refreshing. In that sense, it's quite different from the other book that bears the lady's name, the book of Esther. Well, the book of Esther is all right, but you're moving amongst royalty. You're in the stuffy atmosphere of an ancient Persian king's palace. You're amongst the courtiers and all the cosmetics of an affluent Persian court. But there's a simple country beauty about the book of Ruth that we can identify with in a very, very homely manner. Broadly speaking, those are the facts, the historical facts that are associated with this particular book. A third matter that I would mention would be the changing focus that we will notice as we go through the book. You see, as you travel through the chapters of the book, we will be moving to different locations. And as we move to those different locations, there will be distinct lessons that have to be learned. For the greater part of the Bible reading this afternoon, we'll be on the road. As they're coming back from Moab to the land of Judah, they stop somewhere on the highway and they have a considerable discussion. And on the road we will stop with them and we'll eavesdrop on the conversation of these three lonely widows. When we go to chapter 2, we'll be leaving the road and we'll be coming to the field. And when we go to chapter 3, we'll be beside the floor. Boaz will lie down beside the threshing floor and Ruth will come and take her position at his feet. And when we go to chapter 4, the location will change again. We'll be at the city gate. So we come to Bethlehem in chapter 1. We go out of Bethlehem in chapter 2 into the fields that lay below the city. We move across to the threshing floor, and in chapter 4 we come back again to the city gate, and we complete the circuit of the countryside, and with that changing scenery, we will also have a change in lessons. When we're on the road, it will be a lesson in decision. Those three ladies have to decide what way we go, and that will be quite an important part of our consideration today. When we're in the field, it will be a lesson on discovery, because Ruth will learn the Redeemer's name. She will learn quite a number of the details about his field, and our brethren will be speaking about that later. When we're beside the threshing floor in chapter 3, it will be a lesson there on desire, because Ruth has got to know the Redeemer, and now she feels that she can present her request in his presence. She expresses her desires, and she finds him very, very ready to comply. And when we're at the gate, it will not be decision, or discovery, or desire. It will be destiny, because at the gate, the different legal details will be formalized, and Ruth's future will be secured by the redeeming skill of this particular man. So those are the changing focus as we go from chapter to chapter through the book. Another feature that we will want to mention and will become very evident are the different figures. 8 people are mentioned by name, excepting the genealogy at the end. We have Elimelech, Naomi, we have Ruth and Mahlon, we have Orpah and Kilian, we have Boaz and we have Obed. 8 different figures mentioned in this 8th book of the Old Testament. There are many others who are anonymous. We don't know the name of the overseer in Boaz's field. What about the young men and the young ladies that worked in the field? What about the nearer kinsman who is never named? We have named people, we have unnamed people. In fact, I'm inclined to think that that's one of the reasons the book of Ruth has such fascination for so many people. You'll find lessons here for employers, because Boaz was an employer. There'll be lessons here for employees. There'll be something here for widows. There'll be something here for married people. And there'll be something here for the people who are halfway between and on the way to it. There'll be something here for males. There'll be something here for females. There'll be something here for older people. There'll be something here for younger people. There'll be something here for overseers in assembly life. And I would nearly guess that out of the few hundred people here at the conference in Larne over the weekend, there'll hardly be any single person who won't be touched by some of the figures as we see them appearing in this book, with great variety and with great versatility and with great virtue. Now, the 3 main figures, of course, are Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. And we'll discover, as we look at those figures, and I'll just touch these matters very, very lightly, they'll be well elaborated by our brethren in later sessions. As we come to each chapter, each one of those characters appears in a slightly different light. If we take Naomi, for example, in chapter 1, we'll be thinking a good deal today about her grief. This woman has suffered the bitterness of life's tragic experiences, and she's overwhelmed with grief. And we'll feel her grief as we consider her story in chapter 1. When we go to chapter 2, we'll be thinking about her gratitude. Because when Ruth comes home with all that barley from the field of Boaz, Naomi says, "Blessed be the Lord, which hath not left us without a kinsman." In fact, twice in chapter 1 we will read the woman was left. But when you get to chapter 2, she says, "Well, I thought I was abandoned, but blessed be the Lord, he has not left us without a kinsman." And she lifts a note of praise to the faithful covenant-keeping Jehovah. And a gleam of hope arises in her heart when she sees the armfuls of grain being carried home by her younger daughter-in-law. When you get to chapter 3, it's not her grief or her gratitude, it's her guidance. As a wise older believer, she's able to give guidance to Ruth. And she can tell Ruth how to approach Boaz in a way that will be acceptable to him, and we will be discovering from our brethren in that chapter that her guidance proved to be most effective. And when you get to chapter 4, this old lady that in chapter 1 said, "I'll never have another husband, I'll never have another child. She's nursing a little grandson. And the neighbours around the village are all gossiping and gladly talking. And they say, a son has been born to Ruth. No. No. If anything was calculated to stir a little bit of in-law jealousy, a son has been born to Naomi. And Ruth's nose is put out a little bit. Because it's Naomi that is credited as being the mother. And there she is, nursing her grandson. In chapter 3, her arms are full of grain. She said, I come back empty. Boaz filled her arms with grain in chapter 3. But in chapter 4, he went a step further. He filled her arms with a grandson. And the tragedy was completely turned to tribe. You take, for example, Ruth. In chapter 1, Ruth will be a follower. That's exactly the language he used. She said, entreat me not to return from following after thee, a follower. In chapter 2, she'll be a gleaner. In chapter 3, she's an interceder. In chapter 4, she's a mother. In chapter 1, we'll consider Ruth's faith. That will be, again, a major part of our Bible reading today. The confession of her faith, crystal clear. In chapter 2, we'll be considering, our brethren will consider, her food. She goes out to get food. In chapter 3, we'll be considering her fellowship. Just alone with Boaz, she has communion with the great Redeemer. And in chapter 4, we'll be considering her fruitfulness, her connection with Boaz has become fruitful, and there will be a development in Ruth's story. What about Boaz? He's the third major character. What will you say about Boaz in chapter 1? He's not even mentioned. Well, the word that I write over chapter 1 is this. Boaz is required. He's needed. There's a situation of total penury, and it's a man like Boaz that is needed to remedy it. Boaz is required. But when you get to chapter 2, Boaz is revealed. When you come to chapter 3 and Ruth lodges her request for marriage, Boaz is responding. With alacrity, he responds. And when you get to chapter 4, the man who chapter 1 was required, and the man who was revealed as sufficient in chapter 2, and the man who was responding so readily in chapter 3, he's redeeming in chapter 4, and he's bringing everything to conclusion. So we'll be careful to look at the different characters and to see how they are described, the figures in the book of Ruth. One thing that I would mention just very quickly, and it may come out more as we go through, the format of the book. Books of the Bible are carefully crafted by the Holy Spirit. The format of this book, there are two features, many features that would need to be mentioned. You know, all the features of a great story are just here. Color. Tragedy. Romance. Suspense. Plot. Climax. All the features of a good story. All of you people that study English, you will appreciate what the storyline really is. They're all here. But there are two features of the story that I want to mention, because the Holy Spirit not only gives us a story, but packages it and presents it in a very, very particular way. Number one is this, the speeches in the story. Number two is the symmetry of the story. We will be impressed at how many people talk. You know, over half the book is speech, direct speech, or the report of what people have said. It's by what they say that they reveal their character. Still, usually what a man says or a person says reveals their inner self. You know, when the Bible's giving us character profiles, I couldn't tell you the color of their hair. That would be an important thing if you were writing an English novel. I couldn't tell you anything about their age specifically. Naomi would have been an old widow somewhere in her early 50s. And if you want more information on that subject, we can talk about it. And, I couldn't tell you anything about their weight. Those things are never mentioned as being relatively unimportant in Bible narrative. But every time they open their mouth, they let you know exactly what kind of people they are. So the speech in the book, the great speech of Ruth, the first time that she opens her mouth singly in this book, what a statement will it be? We'll be thinking about it just in a few minutes. So keep your ear open and your eye open for what people say. It will be far more important than how they look. What they say will be the secret to understanding their character. I would say just about the symmetry of the book. And when you're back at school, they'll have in English classes and so on what they call the U format for a story. And the book of Ruth is a U-shaped story in the sense that either end matches and the middle matches. Now you'll discover and we'll discover, and I want to mention it now so that we'll be wide awake for it, that chapter 1 and chapter 4, they match. And then chapter 2 and chapter 3 match. We start with chapter 1, we go down into chapter 2, round into chapter 3, and back up again to the matching part of chapter 4. Apart from the superficial fact that chapters 1 and chapter 4 have 22 verses each. Chapter 1, you remember there's a girl goes back, and there's a girl goes on. In chapter 4, there's a man steps back. He wouldn't redeem it, but there's a man steps forward. In chapter 1, all the women say, "Is this Naomi?" In chapter 4, the women say, "A child is born to Naomi." But the more important connection is this. In chapter 1, we begin with graves. But in chapter 4, we finish with a grandson. In chapter 1, we start with burials. In chapter 4, we have birth. In chapter 1, we have family tombs. In chapter 4, we have a family tree. In chapter 1, we have emptiness. In chapter 4, we have fullness. In chapter 1, death. In chapter 4, we have life. And it's when you get to chapter 4 that you get the full answer to chapter 1 and its problems. And now, just, I'll explain this maybe later on. The little bit in between, chapters 2 and 3, they tell you how to get from the problems of chapter 1 into the prosperity of chapter 4. You get a marriage. Boaz is the man of grace. Ruth is the woman of faith. If you can ever get grace and faith to marry, big things will happen. In fact, the night that I got saved, grace and faith married. And there were big things happen. Whenever faith embraces grace, whenever Ruth embraced Boaz, I tell you, things began to look up. And that's how you get from death to life. Because I think the Bible says, by grace, that's Boaz, are ye saved through faith, that is Ruth. And when the two come together, it's the solution to the great problem of death and disaster. Chapter 2 is a special day. Chapter 3 is a special night. And our brethren will tell us more about that. But keep in mind that the book is carefully constructed. You say, well, you'll have to tell us something about the functions of the book. What's the book all about? You say it's just a nice Bible love story. Not at all. This is not a common love story. This is not the way to carry out your romance. This book of Ruth is not giving us some kind of a pattern for courtships. Not at all. If we read the book of Ruth as giving younger people a kind of idea how to conduct their courtships, we have missed the way. That's not what the book of Ruth. This is a young lady marrying an older man. Well, there you are. That's still done, I suppose. I wouldn't dare to interfere with the higher science of courtship or anything like that. This is a Jew marrying a Gentile. This is a poverty-stricken widow marrying a man of extreme wealth. This is not the pattern. This is not the normal. The Book of Ruth is telling us about something absolutely abnormal. It didn't usually happen. This is not the way that things are done. This is just the way that things are never done. And because it's so unusual, that's what gives the Book of Ruth its intrigue and its interest and its fascination. But what exactly is this book in the Bible for? In fact, I should maybe mention something just before I come to that, and I'm stopping in a minute. A preacher's minute, that is. The framework of the book. You see, this Book of Ruth, as I say, the 8th book in the Old Testament, it is put in different order in other Hebrew manuscripts, so on and so forth. But in our English Bible, it's after the book of Judges, and it's just before the book of Samuel. Now, the book of Judges is a book of anarchy. You know that, and we'll possibly hear more about that. It's a book of anarchy. The book of Samuel is the book of monarchy. How do you get from anarchy to monarchy? How do you get from a state of rebellion to a state of rule? Well, it's the little Book of Ruth that gives the secret. The way you get from rebellion to rule is by redemption. And this intervening link will tell us how God will bring a man and put him on the throne out of such chaos and confusion. He'll do it by the grand services of the institution of redemption. Now the functions of the book, I'll just mention these and then I'll get to chapter 1 just for a very, very brief word or two to let us get into that chapter. I would say there are 5 functions for the Book of Ruth. The first, I'll just mention a couple of these and say then a word or two about some of the others. The first function of the Book of Ruth that we will be interested in, it tells us about the gospel to the stranger. Good news to a stranger, and aliens and Gentiles are being brought into blessing. That's the way that our brethren preach it in the gospel, and we've been singing about it. Can it be that I, an alien, now a child, shall ever be? That's the introduction of Ruth and the gospel to the stranger. You know, the second thing I would say is the book gives us the growth of a soul. Because you can see a development in Ruth. In chapter 1, she's leaving the land of Moab, and she's heading for Bethlehem. She's leaving for the Redeemer's fold. In chapter 2, she's laboring in the Redeemer's field. In chapter 3, she's lying at the Redeemer's feet. And in chapter 4, she's linked to the Redeemer's future. And it's all a beautiful development, and we will see not only the gospel to a stranger, but we will see the growth of a soul in this book. I think another purpose for the book is to show us the godliness of the spiritual. You see, in days of darkness and in days of great disorganization and carnality, there were still godly people there. What about Boaz? What about Naomi? The steadfastness of Boaz, he didn't run away. The submission of Naomi as she comes back. I think that these two characters become models of godly character and behavior. It puts for us in a beautiful frame the godliness of the spiritual. You know, a fourth purpose for this particular book of Ruth is to give us the genealogy of the sovereign. You notice one missing thing in the book of Samuel. We don't get the genealogy of King David. You say that's a serious miss. Yes, the very book that tells us about his coming to the throne never mentions the genealogy of the son. And I can nearly imagine somebody springing up and saying, you know, this boy has very doubtful origins. This fellow's great-grandmother was a Moabite. This fellow shouldn't be on the throne. If anybody made such an objection and try to use the Moabite's blood in David's veins to discredit them, they could turn back to the book of Ruth and say, yes, his great-grandmother was a Moabite. But she was a woman who believed in Jehovah, had a true conversion, and was one of the most spiritual women ever to be seen in the Old Testament. And it silenced all accusations and settled all discontent. It was the genealogy of the sovereign. And I'll not elaborate this because my brethren will do it. I think it's showing the goal for the solitary. Now just, this will be a word that will keep coming up. In the Bible readings, I suspect, especially in chapters 3 and 4, Goel. Now, just for younger believers, the word Goel means the Redeemer. Naomi was a solitary widow, and only for the services of the Goel, she would have died in her poverty and solitariness. The Goel for the solitary, and I would say, and I don't think this will be developed much in the Bible readings, not only the Goel for the solitary Naomi, but it's pointing us forward to the greater Goel for the solitary nation. The nation of Israel have gone into exile. They have, in fact, I remember, I'm taking up time here, but I'll just be brief. I remember Mr. Conduct many years ago having meetings on Ruth. And it came to the first night. And I can still recall when he stood to the platform, he gave out his passage, "Shall we read from the Book of Lamentations?" And everybody thought the man had had a slip. "It was supposed to be the Book of Ruth, sir. And you're going to read from the Book of Lamentations, chapter 1. How has the city become solitary? She has become a widow among the nations." And the good gentleman talked to us about the widowhood of the nation of Israel and her solitariness. And that nation that was solitary and exiled and fruitless and seemed to be on the verge of extinction, by the services of the heavenly Goel, will again be restored to the land, will again be given new life, and will again have the revival of the line that will bring in millennial and everlasting blessing. And the Goel for the solitary Naomi, but Christ is the greater Goel for the solitary nation, all to be seen in this little book of Ruth. It's great flexibility. Now, I have to tell you this. The brethren give us written instructions. You don't know the half of it, you know. We got written instructions for these Bible readings that we could make different observations. I've mentioned that the book of Ruth has an evangelical purpose. The gospel for the stranger. It is a moral purpose. The godliness of the spiritual. It has a practical purpose, the growth of a soul. It has a prophetic purpose, the Goel for the solitary nation. And all of those different purposes, but the Brennan told us we are to emphasize the practical. And whatever allows itself to an assembly application has to be emphasized in the Bible readings. So that's to give both our brethren that contribute and ourselves a little bit of guidance as to where the emphasis would be. I have touched a wider frame of subjects just for the sake of having the Bible reading introduced. Now we're coming down to chapter 1. First thing that I mention in chapter 1 are the parts of it. I call this sometimes the Bethlehem chapter of the book of Ruth. Bethlehem's mentioned in the book 7 times. 5 times in this chapter. And because Bethlehem has such a place of prominence in the chapter, I'll use it for the little outline that I want to follow. And I want you to think about 3 movements. In verses 1 to 5, we have a movement from Bethlehem. In fact, verse number 1 tells us, "A certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went." Mr. Darby and others, and I think it's the right way to have it, "A certain man went from." It's not "a man from Bethlehem went." It's "a man went from Bethlehem, Judah." That one man made a choice that affected his wife and his family. He took them to the land of Moab, and we'll be talking about a movement from Bethlehem. Then from verse 6 down to verse number 19, the beginning of verse number 19a, we have a movement to Bethlehem. 3 widows are coming back, and we will spend a good deal of our time thinking about that journey and that discussion. A movement to Bethlehem. Then in the last little section, verse number 19b down to verse number 22, you notice the words of verse 19. "It came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was moved about them." There was a commotion. And I'll put across that third little section, not a movement from Bethlehem, not a movement to Bethlehem, but a movement in Bethlehem. The city was moved with the arrival of Naomi and Ruth, the Moabitess. Now, that's the parts of the chapter, and that's, I'll say nothing further about the details. I would mention the proportions of the chapter. You know, I think it's very important to see that 25% of the chapter is dealing with going out. Five verses. 75% of the chapter is dealing with coming back. Dear brethren, if there's anything we learn from Ruth, it will be this, that God is the God of restoration. Five verses deals with failure, but 17 verses deal with coming back. Thank God, he follows every step on the way back. He puts the departure, packages it into a small portion, but the restoration, the conversion, and the repentance is so precious to him that he gives it three quarters of the material. The parts of the chapter, the proportions of the chapter, the persons in the chapter, I mentioned the six names, Mahlon and Chilion, Orpah and Ruth and Elimelech and Naomi. But there's a seventh person in the chapter. That's the Lord himself. He's mentioned seven times as Lord and one or two other titles as well. And we can see the Lord moving in all of these different areas. And the principles, just as I sit down, I would say this. In the first five verses, I write across that in my mind, a costly departure. It cost them. It was the easy option, but it didn't finish that way. A costly departure. In the second part of the chapter, I would put across that a costly decision. It was costly for Naomi to come back. It was costly for Ruth. It was costly for Orpah not to come back. And in the third part of the chapter, I would write across that a costly discipline. Naomi bows her head. She says, the Lord hath dealt bitterly with me. The chastising rod has been heavily upon her. And with submission, I admire this lady. She accepts the cost of the discipline, and she comes into the good of restoration, and they come back at the beginning of barley harvest. Now, I had permission to do all of that, just in case you think I'd get the sack. No, I had permission to do that, and I haven't said too much about chapter 1, and that will let us get into this chapter, starting at verse 1. And while our brethren are regrouping there, I might say, before we just come into verse 1, if any of our brethren want to make any general comments about the book of Ruth, maybe if we could do that, and that would let us then come into the section on clean ground, so to speak. General comments about its context or its connections or any of the issues that I raised.
The introduction of the book says the days of the judges rule. So the events of this book take place before Saul was crowned. Would you say that the writing of the book would take place between the coronation of Saul and the coronation of David? I leave you to think about that. Mm-hmm. But what I'm coming to is this book fills a third link with Bethlehem Judah. There are two appendices to Judges. It's 17:18. That covers the idolatry. 19-21 covers the immorality. Now, set over against that is this little book of Ruth that shows fidelity even when the nation in general had got away from God.
I appreciate that very much. I may have said that the book of Ruth is the only book in the Bible that has the last word a proper name. The last word of Ruth is David. And in connection with our brother Mr. Allen's comment about the coronation of Saul and the coronation of David, I think this book is important to show that God had David in mind before Saul was ever on the throne. And the bringing in of David was not a divine reaction to the failure of Saul. The bringing in of David was something that God had already in his heart. So the book of Ruth is showing us the sovereignty of God. Now, just as we... The first five verses are very, very densely packed. And we could get comments, we could move about from all different angles. And I don't want to be too rigid, because we don't go through the Old Testament just verse by verse, word by word, as maybe we try and do in the New. Can you just listen? I've done a lot of talking, but I'm going to draw back. But can I just ask you to follow more or less the following headlines? First of all, we have the times that they lived in. It's the days when the judges ruled. Mr. Allen has helped us there. I'll come back to that in a minute. The times. Then we have the trouble. In those difficult times, a special trouble arrived. Then we have the town. A man went out from Bethlehem, Judah. Then we have the travel. He went to sojourn. Then we have the titles. In verse number 2, they're given quite a number of titles. The names of the people and Ephrathites. Then we have the territory. The end of verse 2, they came into the country of Moab. Then we have the tombs. Three tombs. The man died, then the two boys died. It would seem that in between those deaths we have the two who were married. Then we have the term. They were there for 10 years. And then we have the tragedy. Just to get the tragedy, you notice what it says in verse number 3. She was left and her two sons. You see verse 5. The woman was left off her two sons. It was what was left and still of the two boys. The tragedy reached the bottom when she was left off her two sons, and the three males were completely gone. Now the first thing we mentioned, so the times, our brothers, there are two stories. Did you get what Mr. Allen said? So that we get that. There are two Bethlehem stories at the end of the book of Judges. In the first Bethlehem story, there was a Levite went out from Bethlehem. And he started idolatry. It was ecclesiastical failure. In the second story, there was a concubine went out from Bethlehem. And she got cut up into 12 pieces. It was moral failure. In the third story, in the book of Ruth, there was a man went out from Bethlehem, Judah. Ecclesiastical failure, moral failure, and now it's domestic failure. This man makes a move and goes out from Bethlehem. And that's all the characteristic of the days when the judges ruled. Every man did that which was right. You see, that's great. That's best at times. Everybody did that which was right. If we could only get that to happen, everybody do that which is right. But then there's a wee bit comes in after. Everybody did that which was right in his own eye. That's the problem. That's the times that we're living in. So I think that's you started that. So anything further, brethren, on the times, I would appreciate that. Days of chaos and confusion. And it seemed to rub off onto Elimelech. You know, we're all creatures of our times. We have to remember that.
Would you maybe say something about the famine, David?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of verse 1 in that. Is it 20 times in the Old Testament this is called the land flowing with milk and honey? Strange there should be a famine there. Bethlehem was the house of bread, built on a limestone strata, very fertile, fruitful place. Why was there a famine?
I would think that the famine in the land was likely God's chastisement upon the disobedience of the nation. And sometimes the Lord does allow famine, even in assembly life, because that's where our brethren want us to put the emphasis. He does allow famine conditions to come in. And things seem to dry up, and maybe not so many getting saved, and maybe difficulties in the ministry not so good, and all of that. And don't forget, what I do want to mention is this. It wasn't the famine was the problem. It was Elimelech's reaction to it. It's not the difficulties that put me out. It's my reaction to the difficulties. If I could trust God in the difficulties, it would keep me from making the move which this man made. The famine didn't put Boaz out. And the same faith that sustained Boaz could have sustained Elimelech, but he moved for an easier option. So we've got the times and the troubles, so help us on those things, brethren.
It wasn't the worthlessness of the land, was it?
No.
It was the wickedness of the people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what caused the trouble. And when the people get away from God, I notice in the early verses there's a famine in the home.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be long before there's a famine in the heart. And then there becomes a famine in the hand.
They can't hear these brands, so I think I should take the rest of it. Nearly done that already.
He says, I've got to try it. Oh, that works.
Is it not remarkable that there is famine in Bethlehem, Judah, but no famine in Moab, as you said, about 50 miles away?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a famine across the whole of the Middle East at that time. And so when it was a famine, it was very closely ordered of God just for mm-hmm. that area. Strange. Only the famine in that one area.
Yes, because I think the Lord was dealing with his land and with his people. And those other parts that were outside his jurisdiction, they were still prospering.
Yes, and a strange thing that, just in the one area, strange only in that it was the hand of God. It was a sign that it was divine judgment, or rather just than a natural famine.
That's it. Very good.
I know, David, that he didn't have the book of the Psalms, but the God of the book of the Psalms was still there. And Psalm 33 makes it clear that the Lord was able to save from death and to keep him alive in famine. And as you said, Boaz didn't go.
And the thing, the irony is, the Lord able to keep him alive in the famine. He was afraid of dying in the famine.
He died. Mm-hmm.
But he died anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He went to a land of plenty, but still died. So that sometimes trying to get away from trouble, instead of getting away from it, we only walk into greater trouble.
Mm-hmm.
What seems to be, sir, Brother McBride.
Brother David, two things. One in relation to the departure from the land, and the other in relation to the return. I judge she was a backsliding Israelite, if not a saint, on leaving the land. Thinking of the many that were there and sustained, thinking of Psalm 37, dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Those who did say they were supplied with sufficient to keep them alive. Then again, on return, it was the beginning of barley harvest. I was wondering in our mind if it was the beginning of barley harvest. That was the beginning of the keeping of the seven feasts. The Passover, the unleavened bread, and then the offering of the wave sheaf of the barley harvest. Would that be correct?
That would be correct, and hopefully we'll come to that when we get to that great statement at the end of the chapter. And keep in mind what our brother Mr. McBride has just said. Now the man left Bethlehem Judah and he went to sojourn. That was his thought. That word sojourn has the idea of being just an alien, a resident alien. He says, I'm not going to become one of the citizens. I'm not going to just get too closely involved. But I'm going to be there as a resident alien. And the idea that I'll come back maybe when things get a wee bit easier.
Would it not seem that he went out to preserve the gold in his pocket? I'm thinking of Naomi at the end of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I went out for.
Mm-hmm.
And in days of famine, that's when it's going to affect, isn't it, the finances that we have in hand. And it seems to me that here's a man that's prepared to get away from the things of God just to preserve the gold in his pocket. There are lessons here, I think, for every believer, for us all to glean. For here we see the dangers in departing. And one of the sad things to me is that we have someone here that's just to preserve what he had in his hand. He got away, but he lost everything as a result of it.
Maybe he thought it would be helpful for the two boys.
Mm-hmm.
Many people I see, and I wouldn't make any criticism on this, many people even leave assembly fellowship. They say, well, there's not much there for the young people.
Mm-hmm.
Not much there for the children. And they go to some place where they think there'll be some blame on the boy. blame it sometimes on the children, blame it on somebody else, even apart from children, when all the while the real problem is this: we're not prepared to trust in God.
Amen.
And stay until the difficulties go over. Brother Sam.
Interesting to notice the meaning of the names. Robin has already touched Bethlehem, Judah, which should have been a house of bread and a scene of praise, is found in barren conditions. Sad when an assembly is like that, and it still causes some to drift. But then Elimelech's, his name would be God my King, isn't that right? A man that lived a contradiction to his name. And as you say, he just went down to evade the conditions. He spent longer than he ever intended, and he lost more than he ever thought. A weekend away from God could leave us 10 years in famine conditions. It's sobering.
That's a very, very solemn comment, and I think we should take that very much to heart. We need to be careful. Imagine the testimony this man could have been with a name like Elimelech. My God is King. Book of Judges tells us there was no king. And here's a man has a name which says, there's no king. My God is King. What a testimony could he not have been if he had stayed his ground? And if he had asked his king for permission to leave his land, I don't think the king would have allowed him to leave the holy. He had the name, as our brethren are saying, but he didn't seem to live up to the name. You know, we have great name. Not all saints are saintly. Christians, people that belong to Christ, brothers, not all brothers are brotherly. It's nice to have a good name, but it's even better to live up to it and to live in the good of it.
Does the, the names of the sons, David, they clearly weren't called that at a later stage after being born. That was their name from the very beginning. It's a strange thing then that they were given. Have you any comment on that? I mean, they became that. They may well have become that because of the famine, but they were given that at the very beginning.
I would think they were given that name, Mahlon and Chilion. And our brother's referring to the fact that Mahlon and Chilion means something like sickly and weakly and pining and all that kind of thing. It was Elimelech's parents that gave him the name. So the good name that Elimelech got reflected the strong faith of his parents. And I'm inclined to think that the poor name that he gave his children reflected the weak faith in his own heart.
So he gave them that name. I'm thinking, again, of Christian conditions today, that the father is really saying, this kind of life that he's been born into, isn't he going to be one of wealth and health and happiness?
No future here.
Was that the thought?
This is just a diet. You know, I heard about someone saying that we're just working with the dying embers of the brethren movement.
Aye.
That's what our brother's talking about. Just call them Mallon and Chilion. Sure, this place is not here. Sure, they're going to die anyway. The whole thing's fading out. This man had accepted a situation of defeat and disillusionment. His parents weren't like that. They had a better... My God is King. And if God is King, you never know what changes can take place. But dear brethren, let us not have a defeatist attitude in days of difficulty, because you never know that changes can come. It won't always be famine, because the Lord still visits his people in due time, and he gives them bread.
I'm intrigued, Brother David, by the fact that the Authorized translates the Hebrew word, a certain man. It suggests to me that they're trying to bring over the thought that he was a man of influence and standing and reputation. A man who was a leader, in fact, and the very depiction of a leader and his family would have an impact on that district.
See, that brings us to another side of things. That this man obviously made the move. He was evidently the head of the house. But the decision that he made affected three others. And he himself and his two boys never got back. His wife got back. I'm not saying that she was blameless, and she certainly doesn't exonerate herself, I don't unduly blame Naomi for going. Presumably she acquiesced in it. But when the head of the house said we're going, she had to go, as his wife and the boys were taken with him. And the four went out, but only one comes back. And that's what our brother was saying. We can make decisions that seem to be cheap, but in the longer term they can be exceedingly costly.
David, with regard to where he went, to Moab, now it is very interesting in chapter 3, you will read these words, your enemies, the Moabites. So no matter how much this man rationalized leaving Bethlehem, Judah, and going to Moab, the bottom line is they were the enemies of God's people.
Surely idolatry and incest and immorality and indolence, every evil principle that you can think of, and all kinds of deviant behavior are associated with the name of Moab. And of all places to go, you know, to leave at all was a bad thing. But I could think of a half a dozen places that wouldn't have been as bad as Moab. And if he did leave for the sake of the boys, well, it certainly wasn't a healthy atmosphere to take the boys to. Taking them into the land of Moab, maybe he thought, not just that far away, I've only to cross the Jordan, I'll be able to nip back fairly soon. You know, people still like to dabble, dip into the world. Just a little piece of trendy pleasure. They're just going to border. They're not going to get involved. They'll have a cut-off point. They'll soon get back. We need to be very careful with that kind of rationalization, because you never know just how costly it can be. We're still at the cost of departure.
Okay, isn't it a fact that in Moab it does speak of the ease and of the flesh, and taking the easy path out as far as the world is concerned? And to me it's a sad thing when I see believers that are following that path. They're taking the ease of the world. 23,000 have been killed in one day in Moab. Moab has a tremendous effect upon the saints of God, and it's going to leave another three graves in Moab, isn't it? And the sad thing is that the saints of God, we're taught, they should have been coming up three times a year before the Lord to worship, getting away from God. As they get away from God, here was a man that is going to rob God of his rights spiritually. What I'm trying to do is just to bring it down to the saints of God. If we get away from the things of God, we get away from assembly life, we get away from the fellowship of the assembly, we're robbing God of worshippers, aren't we? God wants worship. And for these 10 years, there was nothing being given to God at all. And we shall see when we come to the end of the chapter, there was nothing to give to God when they got back into the land, which was a very sad thing.
Very sad. And it seems also to me that when they did get away to Moab, it was then very easy for the two boys to marry Moabites. It wouldn't have been just so easy to marry a Moabitish wife when you were still in Bethlehem, Judah. But once you get away from the place, get across the Jordan, your sensitivities are greatly reduced. And an act of blatant disobedience like that is a good bit easier. You know, I would say to younger Christians here, I know that assembly life's not always easy. And there can be days when the prayer meeting's difficult, and days when the remembrance meeting hasn't. But if there seems to be famine, you cling to God. Stay in the place where he has put you.
Amen.
Get down upon your knees and cry to God, and you never know but there's a bounty and there's a blessing may come. Now it's the easy thing to move to some of these fellowships, to move away to something that's more worldly, to something that is more music and has a sense of camaraderie instead of scriptural fellowship. That's all very, very easy. But what we are talking about here is a man that had been given an inheritance. The inheritance that he enjoyed, there were other men that fought for it. It had been gained by fighting. And he left it and he just walked out. And he lost seriously as a result of that. And then the unequal yoke. You know, I was just hearing, somebody was telling me the other day about a young lady. And she came to an overseer. She said, I have a problem I'd like to speak to you about. He said, what is that? She said, I've become very friendly with a young man, but he's not a Christian. And She said, I'm going to have a date, and she says, I think we're going to get engaged, so on and so forth. And the overseer said to her, he says, well, do you think that that's right? Oh, she says, well, I'm praying about it. He says, you don't need to pray about it. You don't need to pray about that. He said, it's not a matter, he told her, it's not a matter of praying on that question. It's simply a matter of obeying. If he's not saved, you don't need to pray whether you'll go out with him or not. You just have to obey. And the Bible says, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. We sometimes dress things up with a religious tunic to try and rationalize it and to make it easier. Here now, you see the thing getting. The territory they went to, the good town that they left, the two that they married, and the three tombs, and the 10 years that was all spent there. Just a story of increasing tragedy.
I was going to ask you, David, would you say here that to some extent we're dealing with chronological order, that Elimelech died, then the boys married? And I just wondered also, maybe if the father's influence was lost and that made it easier for them to take on?
Well, it could well be.
It looks as though that's the order as you read the verses.
It's possible when the father died that Naomi, they said, well, now we'll have to, the boys need to get married here because to carry on this line. And so they marry. And they would say, well, you need to be careful who you marry, boys. You need to marry through Israelites. And marry Israelite lasses. But I say, but sure, they say, what are you so fussy about marrying Israelite lasses? Sure, my father didn't seem to have any concern about Israelite land. And if he didn't concern about the land, why should we get concerned about the lasses? Maybe the compromise that their father made it very easy for these two boys to make the next compromise. He made the compromise in regard to the place. They made the compromise with regard to matrimony. Sorry, Brother Verde.